This is Christy Lescovar, and this is an unabridged recording of my book, One Night in a Bad Inn. This is being recorded in 2011, and I hold the copyright to this recording. One Night in a Bad Inn is a true story about real people. If you would like to see pictures of the people, places, and events in the story, the print edition includes more than 200 historic photographs and maps. And now, One Night in a Bad Inn for Mom and Dad. Wherever men have lived, there is a story to be told. Henry David Thoreau. The bad inn lasts for only a night. St. Teresa of Avila. One afternoon on the Jefferson Slough. It all started when I heard that my great-grandmother was accused of murder. There we were at Auntie Isla's, sitting in the living room, sipping tea, munching cookies, and visiting. After a little while, Auntie Isla got up and left the room. She returned with a large box. She said Sammy had sent it, my uncle. She set the box on the coffee table and opened it. She withdrew a large envelope from the box and from it a piece of paper which she passed to us. I had never seen such a paper. Printed in bold type across the top was Descriptive List of the Prisoner. At the bottom were two pictures of a striking young man, one facing forward, the other to the side. I read quickly down the page. The crime was murder. Who is this? I asked. Archie, Mom said. Grandma's brother, your great uncle. My great uncle? Auntie Mary told us what happened. Oh, my. I hardly knew I had an uncle, Archie. Now I knew why. Then she started talking about the fire and about finding the body and about Grandma T's mother being arrested. I was floored. Was that the time Mother told the man's fortune? Mom asked. No, that was another time, Auntie Mary replied. Another barn-burning story and another scandal. I had heard that one. I never heard any of this, said Mom. I was a middle-aged woman before I knew my mother lived in an orphanage, declared Auntie Isla in reply. Orphanage? Asked my brother Jeff. What was she doing in an orphanage? Nobody seemed to know. I sat there listening to all this, hardly knowing what to make of it. These stories were incredible, and they were about my own relatives, Grandma T's mother and brother, and this on top of all the other incredible stories Mom and Grandma had told me over the years. I knew from those stories that Grandma came from a notorious family, but I had no idea they were this notorious. I also knew that she had endured an unbelievably difficult life, fraught with more hardships and horrors than one person can be expected to bear, and none of it her own doing. I was too shocked and overwhelmed by some of the more dreadful tales to ask questions, so I knew only snippets. And some of the stories were too awful to ask for more details. To do so would have seemed cruel. The important detail I did know was that she refused to have any part in filling that family closet full of skeletons, nor did she wallow in those hardships. She knew she was captain of her own ship with regard to character. She chose to rise above it all, and she did. She was a remarkable lady. Now, 5 years after she passed away, to hear even more stories about her notorious family, it was a lot to take in during the span of one afternoon. The next day I flew home, and as the days passed, Grandma and her story sat quietly in the back of my mind, a pleasant, I'm here for a reason memory that happily would not go away. Mom had been saying for years that someone should write all this down. She said it again that afternoon at Auntie Isla's. Somebody should write a book about this, she said. Oh, no, said Auntie Mary. Why not, said Auntie Isla. So I did. First, I had to find out the rest. I had no idea what I was getting into when I started. The research turned into quite a detective hunt. It took me all over the country and to Europe. It was a tremendous amount of work, very difficult, and loads of fun, and I'm glad I did it. As I gathered family stories from everyone I could find and read and researched and sought to learn about the places and times in which my grandparents and great-grandparents lived and corroborate all I'd been told and discover what I had not been told, the story only grew more interesting, much more interesting. Here's what I found out. We begin with the fire. Part 1, The Forsyth Episode. Chapter 1. It happened during the first week of March, 1913. Grandma was 11 years old at the time. She and her mother and brothers and sister were living in Forsyth, a small railroad and ranching town on the banks of the Yellowstone in Rosebud County, Montana. Her father, Arthur Hughes, still lived on the ranch, the land they had homesteaded 8 miles west of town. On Tuesday of that week, Arthur hitched the horses to the milk wagon and drove into town. He stayed the night at the family home in Forsyth and returned to the ranch the next day. Before he left, he told Tom, their hired man, to come out on Saturday and help him with the fence. He said he'd be back in a few days with a load of hay for the cow. The next was a normal day. Grandma and her brothers attended school. Her mother, Sarah, went to work at the Northern Pacific lunch counter. That evening, Sarah and Tom played casino until Tom went to bed. Sarah stayed up later and finished her mending by the light of the fire. Then she went to bed. It was after 1 o'clock. Then on Friday, as they did every morning, ranchers across the valley pushed back their curtains and looked out at the day to see what Mother Nature had delivered during the night. In her fickleness, she had already brought snow, rain, and sleet that week. Today, nothing. It was clear. But as one of those ranchers peered across the prairie, where yesterday he had seen a house, today he saw a blackened patch of rubble. Sheriff Moses went out to investigate. That's when he found the body, and the rumor started. The man who lived in that burned-down ranch house was my great-grandfather, Arthur William Frederick Hughes. He was born at sea on March 16, 1871, aboard a clipper ship sailing across the South Pacific from Australia to Wales, the first child born to William and Mary Hughes, the former Mary Price. It must have been a fright-filled labor and delivery for Mary, her first child and born on a ship at sea, no less. Why and for how long William and Mary were in Australia, I don't know. Once in Wales, they settled on a house on Cross Lane, in or near Landovery, a quaint farming village on the northwestern edge of the Brecon Beacons in South Wales. It was a verdant, damp land of rolling hills and narrow valleys, wrapped in perennial mist, lending an air of mystery to the place, and perhaps providing fodder for all those legends and superstitions, of which there were many. Whether you cotton to such things and are convinced that bad luck is sure to come to those who fail to obey the decrees of superstition, or whether you dismiss all that and simply attribute life's misfortunes to life's misfortunes, Arthur started very early in life. By the time he was 5 years old, Arthur had 3 younger siblings. His mother had her hands full, so she sent him over the hill to live with his grandparents. He wasn't there long, maybe a year or two, when his grandparents died. For some reason, Arthur didn't go back over the hill to live with his parents. Instead, he went, or was taken, to the dreaded workhouse, the Pauper's Refuge, said to be awful by design so as to discourage anyone from such a fate. The workhouse was to be no better than a laborer's dwelling. If no smoke came from the working man's chimney in the dead of winter, neither should it from the workhouse. The old, the orphan, the insane and infirm, the feeble-minded, all of the destitute lodged at the workhouse, as well as vagrants and some able-bodied poor. Some workhouses had crude beds pushed tightly together. In others, the sleeping space was simply an open area filled with straw surrounded by a curb or a wooden sleeping platform. Not one for each person, mind you, a community sleeping area, the only separation being of men and women. Children such as Arthur attended school either within the workhouse or at the town school, and if he went to school in town, he walked there garbed in formless workhouse attire to serve as a constant reminder of his wretched station. Whether these children should learn to read and write was a subject of debate in 19th century Britain. Were the poor to be educated, they might rise up as the rabble had in France, argued one side. It will only lead to rick burning. Why should workhouse children go to school when most laborers' children do not? Education would give workhouse children an advantage. It wouldn't be fair. Educate those children so they won't remain burdens as adults, argued the other side. Teach workhouse children only to read, not to write, came back as compromise. The countervailing argument, this from the poor law commissioners, was children who learn to read should also learn to write. The debate ended in 1870 with compulsory education. Arthur's mother learned to write. I don't know whether his father did. Of all the women in our story of her generation, Mary Hughes is the only one who learned how to write. I don't know about most of the men. When Arthur was around 10 years old, the workhouse apprenticed him to the Reese Morgan family, who employed him as a farm servant. At some point, Arthur was sent to a pauper school for boys, which was in another part of Wales. What was unusual about this school, for Wales at the time, was that it was a Catholic institution. There, Arthur Hughes learned to read and write in English and Welsh, and he learned to be a stonemason and bricklayer. He was baptized a Catholic, though whether that was before or while he lodged at the school, I don't know. When he left the school, probably as a young teenager, he migrated to the coal-rich Rhondda Valley, a place he was certain to find work.